The following recording may contain explicit language. I can't get more explicit than may. Let's just say it may. It's Wednesday, December 19th, 2018. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. The shutdown, a looming prospect, looming, always looming, that might bring our great capital to a halt. Now, it won't affect essential services, so that's good. The Army's going to go. Screeners at airports. Oh, wait, what's this? USA Today. Neither rain nor snow nor hail nor sleet will keep Santa out of the skies on Christmas Eve. And government shutdown or not, NORAD Santa Tracker will follow the jolly old man's journey every reindeer step of the way. Oh, really? Oh, really? Santa Claus won't be affected because the Santa Claus tracker is an essential service? No, I doubt that's why. I think it has more to do with the fact that while they do tell you that government essential services won't be affected, they don't tell you that imaginary services also will remain unaffected. Oh, wait. If you're listening in the car and kids are listening to this, let me speak to the children right now. Children, I have something perhaps a little disturbing to tell you. Sometimes adults like to make up a good story, a tall tale, if you will, and sometimes it's about a thing or a person that could never happen or exist in the real world. It is fun to delight or amuse children with stories of an outsized character doing things no actual person could do. What I'm saying is Donald Trump isn't real. But great, we got the Santa tracker. So, shutdown looming, always looming.
And now out of the looming government shutdown with Friday's deadline fast approaching, the White House...
Always with the looming and the glooming. But if you look into the details of the shutdown, what's it mean? We got the Army, we got Santa, we've got airports and train stations and the FBI and federal prison, and people still get mailed their Social Security. Look, if you told me, hey, Mike, the subways are shut down, I would say, oh, my God, I need to get places. How can this work in New York? How are you going to get anywhere if you don't have the subways? And then if you said, well, actually, this is what the shutdown means. Limited service on the 5. F's running past Delancey, one's running express, some parts of the G line have been replaced by buses. And I would say, shutdown, you're describing Sunday. That is every Sunday in New York. The shutdown, by the way, is over the wall, and no one who knows anything thinks that Trump is actually going to get his wall. Trump's not even asking for his wall. He's asking for $5 billion that will fund part of the wall, but you know what they call part of a wall? They call it maybe a stanchion or a cinder block that ain't no wall. So we've got a shutdown that's not actually going to shut much down over a demand that no one takes seriously, that if it were to be taken seriously, wouldn't do the job it's designed to do. And you call that looming. An execution looms. Brexit looms. This barely meanders. It wafts above Friday night. It's like the Sabbath to a guy who says he's culturally Jewish, but gets caught eating pizza on Passover and says, oh, when did Passover start? So the shutdown will not smite thee. It looms in the sense of looming being the act of making fabric via thread, by which I mean it's a yarn made up out of whole cloth. And I guess if the cloth were whole, you wouldn't even need the loom. That's my point. We don't need the loom and the doom. On the show today, I spiel about the deficits inherent in democracy. But first, do you think I ruin things? Well, have you heard of Adam Conover? He's the host of Adam Ruins Everything on True TV. Now in its third season, the show takes a frenetic look at big nonfiction issues from guns to mattresses to democracy. He then gets up there, tells everyone they're wrong, and this part's weird to me. They don't appreciate him for it. Adam Conover up next. Adam Ruins Everything is, if you look at it one way, the worst named show on TV because he doesn't ruin everything. He brings nuance and he brings depth of information and even injects a certain ambivalence to many of these issues. But then looked at another way, knowing what I know about human beings, a species that hates depth and nuance and ambivalence, yeah, he kind of does ruin everything. Adam Conover is here. His latest season is underway as we speak and will be continuing apace. Thanks for coming back.
Hey, thank you so much for having me back. I had a blast this last time and I think I'll have one today.
So this is season 3?
Yeah.
Okay. Besides a new slew of topics, any new idea of where you wanted to take the show, new directions that you hadn't gone into in the previous two seasons?
I mean, we're always looking to go bigger and better and top ourselves in those departments. You know, our season premiere this year was about guns. It was called Adam Ruins Guns.
Yes.
And that was always a topic that I said I would never do on the show because of how not just divisive it is, but how much people have their armor up already. As soon as you bring the topic up, they say, I know exactly what I think, yes, and you better tell me what I think or I'm going to change a channel or, you know, write you an angry email, right? And this time, you know, when we started doing the season, I thought, you know, we've gotten really good at making this show. It's our third season. It's our fourth year making the show. And we are very good at doing topics in a way that hopefully everyone in America can watch and enjoy. And that's certainly our goal. And I said, you know, let's really do one of the hardest topics we possibly could and try to do it in that way and try to make an episode that you know, everyone can watch. And I'm happy that we did that. You know, we've got a lot of really light, fun ones as well. We do a lot of bread and butter topics for ourselves. But we also wanted to really push ourselves to do something bigger.
So this is classic Thanksgiving conversation. And right, they're like a genie. You pop out of the turkey and you've got the old man, I think, dad figure,
yeah,
who's a gun guy. And you got, yep, the daughter who's not a gun guy. Now,
yeah,
it is your role to tell them they're both a little wrong and maybe a little right. But I also glean that you didn't want to just, quote unquote, both sides it.
No, definitely
and
not.
You wanted to make it clear. So it seemed to me that the tension wasn't on the do guns stop crime or don't they, or can we ban guns or can't we? It was more of, let us look at the pro-gun argument and contrast that with the limits of solutions. So it wasn't as if you were saying, you know, the pro-gun argument is one solution. That's what the NRA would say. What's our solution to guns? More guns.
Yeah.
You didn't buy into that. But it was more like, let's look at the pro-gun argument and let's contrast it with all these things that you say that can correct the problem. Will they really correct the problem?
Yeah. I mean, we were under no illusions that we could solve the gun debate.
No, you're just there to ruin it. The promise, yeah, is that you'll ruin it.
Yeah, that's it. And so we just wanted to make sure we were having a productive contribution to the conversation, right? You know, we start the episode, the dad and the daughter are having a conversation, and it's no one needs an assault rifle versus the founding fathers, you know, guaranteed me the right individual right to own a gun in the Second Amendment, right? That's the conversation we're having with each other.
Yes.
Both of those premises are wrong, right? The assault rifle, in my view, is not the place that you should start. And the founding fathers were not thinking about your individual right to a Glock when they wrote the Second Amendment. They were talking about your ability to serve in a militia. And that's, yes, a matter of historical fact,
yes,
right? Even the NRA's role in changing the definition of what the Second Amendment meant is misunderstood by most people. And so when we did that act, that's the second act of the show, we talk about how that changed, right? It wasn't until, you know, even a couple decades ago, people, you know, the idea that the Second Amendment guaranteed an individual right was being laughed out of law schools. You know, no one really believed this. It was a very fringe opinion. And then through sustained, focused effort in the courts, in the legal community, the gun rights folks pushed their case, and then they took it all the way to the Supreme Court, and they won. And the fact is, that doesn't mean it's false. That doesn't mean that that it's all a sham, right?
Right.
That is how the meanings of amendments change. The, yeah, same process happened with the right to privacy, with how our meaning of the First Amendment has changed.
So before you did this episode, how much of what you just told me would you have been able to?
I love that question. I've never been asked this before. I learn a lot during the research process of the episode. You know, we said going into our writer's room, we want to do this episode. I had a couple thought starters that made me think, I think there's something there. I had read a long form piece of journalism on this very issue about how meaning of the Second Amendment has changed. And I had heard a wonderful episode of Radiolab. I think that episode was called The Gun Show. Really great. And then I just brought that to our writer's room and we started having a really robust discussion about it. And, you know, senior researcher, Sam Roudman, who has a journalism background, you know, had a lot of like, oh, we should talk about this. We should talk about that. Here's an issue people don't bring up. And then we're lucky to have a very diverse writer's room. People start talking about their personal experiences, you know. And so then we sort of figure out what's our research program and we start fleshing it out. And at that point, I start learning from our staff and they start bringing stuff to me. Hey, here's what we should talk about.
So I wanted to ask you about how you assembled the writer's room. Is it funny people, comedy people who also are interested in nonfiction, or is it journalists who are funny, or a combination?
We look for a really good mix, you know. We have writers and we have researchers. It's, and they're working together cheek by jowl in the same room. But
which ones
know.
Are jowlier?
I'd have to say the writers. I think they get the least exercise. But
you can be funny. You don't really have to work too hard. Yeah.
It's always good when, you know, a lot of our researchers are funny folks and are able to help close that gap for us, because a lot of times we're looking for, okay, here's the fact, and then how do we get to the joke from the fact? And a lot of times when our researchers can go, oh, actually, you know, what if we show Reagan doing XYZ, that can help us out. When they can help us close the gap of translating the fact into a little piece of story where you're boiling it down to the narrativized version, and that's what you can write the joke off of. And then for writers, you know, we are looking to hire folks who are funny comedy writers, but who are also very curious, who read a lot, who are, you know, nonfiction people, you know, and are, you know, sort of can think deeply about these issues. But then, of course, you know, we just at the same time, we just hire some funny joke folks, because, you know, when you're looking to put a room together, some comedy writers are extremely serious. This writer is extremely serious, and they're really going to handle the information well. And then this is just some silly person who likes jokes, and you know, maybe we'll give them an assist when it comes to time to like writing the facts out. But you know, they're mainly going to bring a lot of levity to the room.
So if I asked you to look back to episode one, those episodes would be more. What if? So this is the what have you learned question. Would they be more jangly? Would they be overly ambitious? How do you think you've improved from those episodes? What mistakes aren't you making?
I think about that a lot, because our research process has gotten better. You know, we've gone from having literally our first year, we had one research staffer. This year we had five plus a head of research, which is what we should have had from the beginning. So the guy the first year, wonderful man named Clark Caldwell, did great work, but you know, he almost killed himself. You know, also, you know, I'm sure the show is, you know, I'm sure we make less mistakes now than we did then, and we've also learned how to sound like we're going out on a limb with my rhetoric without actually going there. You know, like, you want to make something sound as spicy and fun as possible. You want to make the biggest statement possible, but you don't want to, you know, overstate your case, right? So for instance, one mistake that we made was our first year we did an episode called Adam Ruins Voting.
Yes.
Which was about, you know, hey, the myth is, hey, one person, one vote, your vote counts as much as everybody else's. American democracy is the greatest democracy in the world, right? And we said, no, actually, there's a lot of systemic things that prevent that from being the case. For instance, gerrymandering. You know, and that was the clip that we put online. Gerrymandering means that the politicians are choosing the outcome of the election before you even vote, right? Mm-hmm. Now, at the end of the episode, I say, hey, we do a positive takeaway at the end of every episode. We say, hey, this is an argument for why you should go vote, because American democracy used to be much worse, used to be much less democratic, and we've only improved it through the democratic process, right? Well, occasionally we have to have a civil war, but apart from that, you know, we use democracy to improve democracy. So the fact that it isn't perfect doesn't mean you don't have the responsibility to participate. The problem is that last little bit didn't go on YouTube. Only the gerrymandering bit went on YouTube. And so people started sharing it saying, aha, Adam is right. Because of gerrymandering, I won't vote. And we were like, no, that's no. And so we learned a little bit about that, you know.
I wanted to ask you about one more specific thing. Your show is pretty fearless on taking on specific companies by name. There was the episode you did about the cabal of eyeglasses, and it's very much like the episode this year about mattresses, which is part of a larger sleep episode. You ever get any pushback on that? Standards and practices say, hey, man, this is a...
We do.
I don't even know if it's standards and practices, but the ad sale guys
ad
say
sales.
You can't go after Casper to this extent.
Well, there's two halves of it. So we talk about Casper in that episode, and we also talk about, you know, Mattress Firm, which is the very clever name of, you know, a Luxottica-style mattress, you know, sort of semi-monopoly that we have in the
US.
Used to be Sleepy's. Yes. Well, yeah, I think Mattress Firm bought Sleepy's. And so it's one of those vertically integrated, that they're making the mattresses, they're selling them. And yeah, but we also talk about how those online mattress companies aren't much less scammier than the brick and mortar places. That no matter what you're doing when you're buying a mattress, you're getting screwed somehow, right?
Yes.
And those mattress
but
companies,
you know what? The 100-day money back guarantee.
But come on. First of all, you are brave working in podcasts to criticize Casper at all.
Well, like, plugging their money back.
And up
guarantee.
Next, we're going to tell you about Squarespace and Stamps.com is a real ripoff. But getting back to Casper, I mean, that 100-day money back guarantee, we can't cut it. No, we got to do do this. The 100-day money-back guarantee, I mean, let's face it. That's based on you can't comparison shop when you're getting a Casper. And when you return it, they just call someone who throws it away. There's no returning a mattress. They're just putting it in the dumpster, right?
Right, right. So if you're an environmentalist, it maybe
isn't the... But what they're really doing is they're solving your shopping problem. I want to get a mattress. I don't want to go to a store. Oh, this will be in a box. I heard about it in a podcast. Great. Showed up at my house. Good enough, right? So there's two halves that make it, you know, we have to be careful about when we're doing this. We have a legal department, you know, watching out for everybody's interest and make sure that we're not, you know, saying anything that we're going to be held liable for. But look, we've only ever had one topic completely killed. And that was, I wanted to do something on the NCAA and how it's completely unethical that they don't pay athletes.
True TV.
They have the first round. They air it in March. And they said, this is when we make our money. We have this relationship and we can't do it.
Did you think about that beforehand? Were you drawn to it because you knew you're like, you know, a moth to flame?
I'll be honest, I was. Yeah. I was like, first of all, I really wanted to do it because it's one of the most unethical things. And we're doing a college episode. But, you know, what I do is I am a little confrontational and I'm like, yeah, I want to do this and I'm going to make them tell me no. Right. And the way I found out no is the head of the network told me himself, we cannot do it. Right. And so that way, that's how I know I can sleep well at night, is that's the only, I fight as hard as I can. And the only way that I take a no is when it goes that far. Right.
So the way you sleep at night is not with a mattress with just the right firm and just the right bounce. That's not the way.
I sleep on a futon. No, I sleep on a straw mat on the floor. No. apart from that, you know, we've gotten everything through that we wanted to get through. And by the way, they're letting us talk about the NCAA incident on the show.
Oh, cool.
We're doing later this year, we're doing a segment about our relationship with advertisers and what that means about the show. And we're discussing this. But, you know, there have been a couple other times in the past where, you know, we just, it's a conversation that we have to have, right? About like, can we not, even though you're telling the truth. So a good one that we did was we did a segment on dating sites and on how, you know, dating sites that claim to scientifically match you. That's not science, right? It's just nonsense. They're just, you know.
Well, the apps work basic. Work because of science. I mean.
They have technology, but they don't have any special, you know, matching formula that is better than you just going on dates yourself, right? Yeah. And so we do, an eHarmony is the one that makes the biggest scientific claims.
Yeah.
They say they have 21 proven dimensions or whatever the hell it is. And, you know, they have those really iconic commercials that we wanted to parody. And so we did that and, you know, they advertise like hell. And so the network said, hey, look, obviously you can do this, but don't disparage that. Say the truth, right? But don't like disparage the main guy too much. You know, don't parody him and say like, oh, hey, I'm eHarmony guy and I eat a bowl of crap for breakfast and here I am, you know, farting and pooping my pants. Yeah. And you know what I mean? Like, don't be like needlessly cruel, right? Just say they make this claim. This claim is false, right? And I can live with that because that's just on jokes, you know, et cetera. So we'll have that sort of conversation. But, you know, the number of times that we've had to have that conversation, I'd say out of, we're going to be in about 70 episodes, right? By the end of this run, three episodes a segment. So, you know, 280 segments. And I think we've had a conversation like this a half a dozen to a dozen times, right? Out of them, where it's like, look, you know, this company puts some, you know, they actually invest in the network. We don't want to be needlessly antagonistic. We know what your show is. Can we have a conversation about it and make sure that we're not overdoing it? And we've never run anything. We've never, you know, had to take the teeth out of a segment. And I'm proud to say that.
Adam Conover is the titular Adam of Adam Ruins Everything. The new season is upon us. Let the ruining begin. Thank you, Adam.
Thank you so much for having me, Mike. This is a blast.
Absolutely. And we should also mention that Adam Ruins Everything. Use the discount code RUIN for 50% off your purchase of your next mattress.
No, Arch, is there really? No. Okay. Oh, you ruined me. That was a wonderful prank.
and now we are sliding into the Impractical Jokers, True TV's other beloved show.
Oh, are they here? Oh, they're the best. Those guys are the best.
Staten Island hijinks. Thanks, Adam.
Hey, thank you, ma'am.
And now the spiel. In a new Hill TV / America Barometer poll, released Friday, 58% of registered voters say they believe that the Mueller inquiry into Russian interference in the election is unbiased. 42% say biased. In another recent poll, 62% said that Trump was untruthful when it came to Russian interference, but 38% did not. Is this good? Because these polls are usually played on TV as presidents in trouble, people not believing the president. But I think that 58 or 62% is disturbingly low for an opinion that should be blindingly obvious. Those 38% who just don't see Trump as being untruthful in this Russia thing, are they nuts? Are they lying? Are they stupid? Are they being untruthful to themselves? Last week, CNN did a poll of public opinion on special counsel Robert Mueller, and he wasn't looking that great. Mueller's approval rating, CNN told us, was 43%. 40% disapprove. Why would I care if the American people disapprove of Robert Mueller? What do they know of Robert Mueller? Do they have law degrees? Are they read into the appropriate statutes? Were they surprised to see that he indicted Russian troll farm worker Alexandra Yurievna Kirillova, but wondered how Sergei Grigorenko managed to escape scrutiny? Was that the truck they had with Mr. Mueller? Approve or disapprove, that's for politicians, because you ask voters, do you approve or disapprove? Because voters are essentially the hiring and firing committee for a politician. There is no public good stemming from knowing the public's opinion on a person whose job they don't understand, who is governed by statute, not their approval. I guess more knowledge is better than less, so you could argue now you know what the rest of the citizenry thinks about Mueller, but I do think this poll made me a little bit stupider. It certainly made me more aware of how stupid in general the public is, which brings me to my larger point. Most complaints about democracy, voter suppression, anti-majoritarian clauses in the Constitution, low turnout, Steve Ducey, the Electoral College, most of these, though apt, do not get to the fundamental problem of democracy, which is this. Our fellow Americans are stupid, deeply, deeply stupid. Not all of them, but a lot of them, and disturbingly, sometimes most of them. Sometimes they're not stupid, they're ignorant. Sometimes they're ignorant and stupid. At some point, being aggressive and avoidably ignorant equals stupidity. So I think we know this, we might not want to admit it, but when we're confronted with the fact, we usually think of people on the other side who are stupid and we decry or loathe, or, you know, we can explain away why they're stupid. We maybe say they're victims of deeper trends, they're victims of social media or active disinformation campaigns or information siloing. But I always think about psychology, because we can correct for the specific conditions that make people wrong about things. I suppose we can regulate Facebook or somehow make Fox News be less insidious, but we can't correct for human nature. Compare the US to the UK. Similarities, but a lot of differences in media consumption. In the United States, the broadcast media is not that good. The print media is generally better. There are some bad print outlets, but the best newspapers like the New York Times and the Washington Post pretty much drive all the media. And there's some good broadcast outlets, but the most watched of the cable news channels is Fox News. It's more watched than CNN and MSNBC. Britain's the exact opposite. In Britain, the ne plus ultra of media is the BBC. So broadcast is not only the best, it's the most watched, and they drive the conversation. And then the print media, though there's some good print media, kind of fills in the blanks and often in a tawdry way. And yet still, for these almost exact opposite media configurations, still, we both made cataclysmically stupid decisions, Trump and Brexit. And what explains that? I think human nature. What I want to avoid focusing on is looking at the 38% of people who think that Trump is telling the truth and blaming them or picking apart their flaws. Because there are many of those within the 62% who we don't have an instinctive aversion to, who exhibit many of these same flaws. And let's look at one of them to explain how these bad decisions, misimpressions form. And recently we were given a gift. A respected and too many beloved author, Alice Walker, was being interviewed by the New York Times about what books are on her nightstand. And she said, "David Icke's And the Truth Shall Set You Free." Here is how Vice describes David Icke.
It was in 2000 that I first discovered David Icke's book, The Biggest Secret. In it, he writes about a global conspiracy, a hidden hand manipulating humanity's destiny through the shadows, using those who seem to be in power. And the goal of these shadow people? Nothing less than an Orwellian global superstate with total control at the hands of an ancient reptilian shape-shifting race.
Yes, the lizard people. David Icke. I thought it was Ick or Icky, and it is, but it also is technically Icke. David Icke believes the lizard people are trying to take over the world. Now, there is a critique of Icke that he only uses lizard people so that critics think he's cute and a little wacky, because what he really means by lizard people is the Jews. Now, we have to be clear. It's not like he also doesn't specifically malign the Jews. It's not like he doesn't over and over again take his time to degrade and blame the Jews. But at a certain point, he shifts from Jews to lizard people, I guess, when the anti-Semitism turns from the all-in-good-fun kind to the slightly aggressive kind. I don't know. So when Alice Walker says of the works of David Icke, it's a curious person's dream come true, criticism was levied against, of course, the New York Times. Huh? Yeah. The Anti-Defamation League called out the New York Times. The Washington Post story I read about this was titled "The New York Times Assailed for Alice Walker Interview Endorsing Anti-Semitic Conspiracy Theory." I would have gone with a different headline, like "Alice Walker Off Her Rocker" or "The Color What Now?" No. The Times. Now, of the three proper names in Alice Walker, David Icke, and New York Times, it was the Times that came in for scrutiny. I guess the Times should have, as soon as she said that the book was on the nightstand, have jumped in and say, "How dare you?" and knocked her nightstand over and said, "You shan't be telling tales of lizard kings." I don't blame the New York Times, actually, for letting me know that Alice Walker walks with the lizards. I suppose in a perfect world, there might have been an editor's note, but that would have broken the format of this piece, and that would have been a precedent for maybe lizard-splaining to an acclaimed author. And a perfect world? I mean, really, how perfect is the world if it's run by the Brethren of Barney? Alice Walker actually wrote a poem reflecting a lot of the David Icke worldview. She talked about learning about Zionism from YouTube. Here's some of that. "I recommend starting with YouTube. Simply follow the trail of the Talmud as its poison belatedly winds its way into our collective consciousness." Here's another section of that poem. "But hang in there checking and double checking, listening to everybody, even the teachers with the twisted pasts that scare you the most, and the taped rants of outraged citizens that sound like madcap characters on Car Talk, except they are not laughing, but are righteously outraged. Car Talk. Don't drive like my anti-Semitic reptile theorist." Here's why I bring Alice Walker up. Walker's not all right. She doesn't wear the MAGA hat. She doesn't post on Twitter using four emojis in her name, including both versions of Eagle. She is a figure so respected on the left that she merits an interview about the contents of her nightstand by the New York Times. And yet she is still deeply ignorant in a way that threatens democracy if opinions like hers become mainstreamed. And the way it happens is, I believe, she goes down a path. She finds something that she agrees with that piques her intellect that may be actually defensible. So the equivalent of someone on the right would be they hear something Milo says and thinks it's clever. Or back in the day, they heard something Bill O'Reilly saying about political correctness and said to themselves, "Yeah, that goes too far." Or there's a Facebook post about some microaggression on a campus and they say, "That's ridiculous." And then other information that comports with this worldview is sought, or not even sought. It's just served up by social media. And there is a quest for answers. Or maybe there's no quest, or a very low grade, incurious quest. But still, more information of that type somehow fills in the gaps. Because rather than sit with uncertainty or chalk up contradictions as just a fundamental quality of life, rather than say, you know, there might be some inconsistency in the universe, there is this human need to fill in the blanks. So with Alice Walker, it might start with a legitimate critique of the actions of Israel. And then, because she's schooled in Chomsky and Howard Zinn, but also others who were themselves schooled in Chomsky and Zinn and became a little more radical. And she endorses and is exposed to a worldview that use against moderation, use against innocent explanations, towards a worldview that says there are strict answers. Explanations are always favored over just sitting in ambivalence, and a narrative takes hold. And a narrative has through lines, and a narrative has themes. The novelist in Alice Walker can tell you that. But we've all been schooled in narrative. Yuval Hariri says it is inherent in our nature. It makes us human. Maybe that's true. Even if it's only a little true about our nature, we've all been nurtured. We've all suckled at the teat of narrative. We're steeped in narrative. We're trained at narrative. And it's easier to offer up explanations that fit with our narrative than to acknowledge a fact that breaks with it. So 38% still can't see Trump as lying about Russia because they have a greater story in their head. It's about America being a corrupt place, sclerotic and a swamp. And there's Trump shaking things up. And of course, he's going to be opposed by the powerful. And it's hard to acknowledge a plain fact that explodes our narrative. And it's easy to only expose ourselves to those facts which comport with our narrative. Alice Walker might believe in these fringe conspiracies about the Jews and lizard people because it is the ultimate expression, or at least a ultimate expression, of more mainstream theories, which sometimes end unsatisfyingly, where you have to say, well, maybe in that case, Israel was justified, or, well, maybe we are imposing our values from afar, or, you know, maybe the Palestinians are at least equally to blame. Complex problem, easy narrative. I think modern life has so much data to offer that unless we organize it, we're at its mercy. So we create these structures. We create these narratives. It really becomes the only way we can function. Narrative gets us through the day, but it also often takes us down a wild, wending path, which ultimately results in farce, either on your nightstand or at the ballot box. And that's it for today's show. Pierre Bien-Aimé and Daniel Schrader produced the show. You know, every day I write up my thoughts and I send them to the guys, and the misspellings and typos abound. But I just wanted to share with you, as I literally read from a sentence that I wrote to Pierre and Daniel today. Though I'd argue evasionale ignorance form of stupor varasht people, here's the deal, thwarted by a fub-dab-stab-style flaw. TJ Raphael is senior producer of The Gist. She apologizes for not putting the trigger warning in before I said teat. Some people find teat disturbing. Sorry not to have included that. The Gist, you know, perhaps loving too much is my real fub-dab-stable flaw. Umpru-depru-dupru, and thanks for listening.